by 99.5 FM. Bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests and co-hosts to help you lead a more positively minded life. In the studio with me today, my friend Dr. Bernard Starr. Bernie, who's done a lot of questions into the concept of the positive mind. Bernie, welcome back.
Hi, Armand. Hi there. Great to be here.
Hey, Bernie, the positive mind, we call it. We call it the positive mind. We call it the... Well, you got to go back to my music. Here we are. Yeah, hi, Bernie.
Hi, hi, Armand.
Okay, hey, listen, Bernie Starr, who's one of the great scientists and researchers who's written quite a bit about consciousness and spirituality, let me talk to you about this. So Bernie's been with me for a while here, and we asked this question that came up yesterday. And the question that came up yesterday was about what is the mind. We had called our show The Positive Mind, and Leora called and asked, what is the mind? And so she comes on the air, and she, you know, Armand, what is the mind? And it's like a typical Leora challenge. But it was a very interesting question. What is the mind? And it is a question. What is that thing you call your mind? Is your mind something that... Is it everything you think? So let's look at a typical Western human American or European concept of the mind and how we see it. According to the research that I've done and what I understand is people consider the mind to be what you think. Everything you think is in your mind. So if you think it, that's your mind. You see, your mind is a thing that has all these words running around inside it. People say to each other, you know, your body may be different than the other body, but it's your mind that makes the difference. You know, a woman will say, I'm attracted to him. He's a very attractive man, but I've got to meet a man with a good mind. What is mind? What is mind made of? So, Bernie, let's introduce it from there. You know, what is the mind made of according to what most people believe the human mind is?
That's a great question. That's a great question, what is the mind? And people have pondered that from the beginning of time because we live in our minds. All we know is mind from the beginning of our existence. We experience everything through our minds. And when we talk about mind, we're really talking about thoughts because thinking and thoughts is the language of mind. So everything is filtered through that. And in our ordinary experience, we know nothing else. So we love our minds. We think it's our most unique feature. We think it defines us. We think it is the very basis of our existence in life. So we revere it a great thing. It's everything to us.
And at times we hate our minds. Because our minds could torture us, because our minds could be so filled with negative thought that you hate your mind. Sometimes when you're depressed, boy, you'd like to cut off your mind and throw it in the garbage, you know, or people who drink or people who take drugs are obliterating their mind because they hate their mind, because their mind is filled with these thoughts.
That's true, and most of our conflicts are conflicts with our thinking, of how we think about things. So very often we are at war with our minds. We're divided.
So a question becomes, well, if a mind is not what you think, is it all about your logical process? Is it all about how you put things together? Is that what your mind is? Is it all about how you figure things out? Let's throw a couple of factors in here. We have learned from the positive mind, this radio program that's with you every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday at 1 o'clock, that there are other things that take place in your mind that you don't know about. Like, for example, your chemistry. You could have, for one reason or another, something that gets triggered inside you that will make you think a certain thing. And let's start off with the magic of the amygdala, this nice little pea-sized organ in your brain. If you have overactivity in your amygdala, your brain fires very rapidly, and the first thing it does is it triggers off a question to the primitive defense systems, and the primitive defense system says, oops, we're nervous, there must be danger, because the amygdala was built as a way of perceiving danger before it happens, you know? So the amygdala is your nervous one. It's the one that's going to protect you. So then your body goes into a, we're afraid of something, something must be dangerous, something wrong must be happening, and the amygdala goes up there, and then the brain, the defense system, goes into your videotapes that it has up in your mind and says, what could we be afraid of? Well, maybe we're afraid of the guy walking down the street, because it plays scenes of people walking down the street attacking you. And then you say, okay, I see a man walking down the street and I am nervous. Therefore, I blame the man walking down the street for making me nervous. But what we know is that sometimes the amygdala fires, and that which you think is a result of the firing of the amygdala. For example, you could drink 3 cups of coffee and walk out of your house, and you could be a nervous wreck. And everything that happens to you in your mind is as a result of the coffee. You could be on a monthly menstrual cycle, and you could have a drop in estrogen. And you could have your estrogen could be so low, and you could feel so depressed that you walk out of your house and you see doom and gloom. So the mind, as we're saying it, very often can be affected by your chemistry. However, we don't like to see that. I mean, classically is, say to somebody who's premenstrual, you're premenstrual, and they'll say, no, I'm not. Almost like you're taking away my identity. So then we have one factor, which is the chemical part of ourselves, and there are so many chemical things that could make you think different ways. I mean, they could shoot you full of drugs, and they could give you, if they give you cocaine, you react one way. If they give you Rohypno, they make you feel romantic. If they give you, ecstasy, you feel a certain way. There are drugs that dictate your mind.
That's very true, Armand. As you're indicating, everything is filtered through the mind, whether we're talking about physiological reactions or whether we're talking about just mental activities. And I think that's one of the challenging things in us evaluating our experiences and evaluating and trying to find out who we are. That is, what is coming from our biology, what is being triggered, what things are on automatic because of that, and what else is happening from our psychological minds.
Well, that's what kind of separates us. Because what the average person does is they don't question their mind. And let's take a case of prejudice. You know, I mean, prejudice is really kind of foolish. How could you be prejudiced? How could you say there's a race of people out there who I believe are all bad? There's a group of people out there who are all bad. How do you do that? How can you possibly say that everybody of a certain color is wrong, or everybody of a certain religion is wrong? Is that your mind at work, or is it something else? Is it some group force? Is it something else that's working? Is it your heredity? Is it your attachment to your family? Is it your emotional responses? What makes you think those funny thoughts? There's also primitive drives that make you think funny. Primitive things like possessiveness, jealousy, even hunger will make you think certain things. If you're hungry and you're passing a shop that sells something that's readily digestible and a quick source of sugar, like an ice cream shop, your stomach is going to dictate to your mind, I gotta have some chocolate. I gotta have it. So this mind of yours, this mind that you think is all yours, now says to yourself, well, no, I shouldn't eat chocolate, or I should eat chocolate. But you think this is dictated by a willful argument inside yourself about chocolate. And it's not. It's being set off by some chemical archaic system.
Okay, well, that introduces an interesting question, because for sure we have these spontaneous reactions and we feel compelled to react in a certain way. But the question is, can we separate ourselves from that in any way? Can we resist these compulsions? And here I think we're getting to what you just mentioned a few minutes ago of whether we're totally victims of these experiences that we have, or whether we could take charge in some fashion, or whether we could separate things out. And, of course, here we're talking about closed minds and open minds, especially when you talk about prejudice. When I was making phone calls for Barack Obama and speaking to people in Pennsylvania, some of them said, I don't like black people, and I'm not voting for him, period. You hardly know what to say to these people.
So the mind, you know, I mean, some of the other factors that will affect you is your heredity, you know. I mean, you could be hypnotized. We were talking about taking possession of your mind. When you're a child, if you hear often enough from your parents that, you know, you should never put your hat, I remember one, never put your hat on a table or your shoe, no, never put your shoes, never put your hat on the bed was the expression. Never put your hat on the bed. What a silly kind of question, never put your hat on the bed. Why never put your hat on the bed? Well, my grandmother said never put your hat on the bed, and her grandmother said never put your hat on the bed. And so we had this thing about never put your hat on the bed, and so if I would put my hat on the bed, if I'd drop it on the bed wearing a cap or something, grandma would scream, "Don't put your hat on the bed." And I would say, "Why?" And she would say, "Don't." Well, what was it was from was in the Eastern Europe, which she came from, they were lice. And that part of the problems that people carried is they carried lice, which was in their hair. And if you put your hat on a bed, you might put lice in the bed. So the rule of don't put lice in the bed or don't put your hat on the bed made a little sense. But if you carry it long enough, then here's what happens. Somewhere later in life, 20 years later, I'm passing by and I see a hat on a bed and I get nervous. Why do I get nervous when this took place 60 years ago or 70 years ago? Because it's in my brain somewhere. I've been hypnotized. I now have that message running around. How many of us have messages running around that make no sense whatsoever? Like the rules that we see that make no sense. Don't park here for 5 minutes. Don't do things. They make no sense. Some things make no sense. We live with that every day. Our own minds don't make any sense.
So I think where you're going with this, Armand, is a bigger question here, which is, do we actually, we say my mind, you know, it's my mind. We love it. It's important. It's our central feature. But are we actually in control of it? Do we live through our minds? Do we control our minds? Or are we lived by our minds? Does the tail wag the dog here? And it's an important question, because when we talk about my anything, if I say my car, my television set, I don't go into the car and say, "Car, where are we going today?" Right? It's my car. I drive the car and I take it where I want to go. Or if I put on the television set, I watch the programs that I want to watch. I don't say, "Television set, what are we watching today?" But what you're indicating with your examples here is that's not what often happens when we're operating in everyday life through mind. That when we look closely at it, it's the tail wagging the dog.
You know, it's kind of interesting, because one of the beautiful things about being a child, well, I guess not you guys, but me growing up, I mean, if I would get caught doing something I shouldn't do, I grew up in a fairly religious family, I would every now and then turn around when I was really lost for something to say, I would say, "The devil made me do it," you know, as if there was an outside force. But there are outside forces that make your mind do things, and these forces are not what you think they are. Are you in control of your mind? Is the idea to be in control of your mind, or is the idea to have less control over your mind, to let it all go? So here's what we're looking at today. Today we're looking at the nature of mind and what mind is. And here on the positive mind, what will lead you to a more positive mind? And here's basically what I've found. I found that the more upset you get about things that you don't look at, the more upset you get about things that you don't have any idea of what it is and you're just reacting to, the more unhappy you are. That if you could take a step back, like Bernie's saying, and you could in some way, I guess the word is, what is the word, disconnect, Bernie? In some way, what are you looking to do? You want to space?
Well, a lot of the spiritual traditions talk about detachment. But detachment's a lousy word, though, because it suggests being unfeeling, being uncaring, which is not the way it's meant.
But if I want to step back from myself, if I were to look...
Stepping back is much better, I think.
I want to step back from myself, and I want to look at my mind and see what it's thinking at any given moment. What's it thinking? You know, what's going on? What's this... Why am I in this quandary? Why am I worried about this? Why am I scared? And it's not just a question that you answer with logic. Because what you have to do is you have to tune into a lot of different things. Is my reaction automatic? You know? And I think that's what leads people to go to number one, therapy, which is usually helpful in helping you sort that out. But really, introspection. This is the nature of introspection. Finding out how to separate what you're thinking from what you're really thinking. You know, is it kind of automatic or not?
Well, but here's the problem, Armand, that most of us feel that we are in control, that we are the masters of our own mind. And the reason for that is our conscious presence, that we're here. So we experience everything as I'm in charge. So before somebody could step back, which is a great idea, and that already suggests some progress and an open mind and some kind of evolution of your consciousness, the person has to experience that they're not in charge, you see. And how do we get to that? I mean, there are ways of doing it.
Well, most people know they're not in charge. They just act like they're in charge. I mean, if you ask most people, are you in control of your life? Most people say no, you know, but if they had to say it to their kids, they'd say yes. If you had to say it to somebody who you wanted to look good to, you'd say yes. But most people know they're not in control of their lives.
Of their lives, but they think they're in control of their minds. And there they're probably getting that notion because they're thinking only in terms of major decision-making, where they do have this conscious presence and this sense that they're working on an issue, working on a problem. But what's happening most of the other time? And there's one way that's very powerful in demonstrating this, and I think it's, when I realized this, I found it kind of mind-blowing, as I think everybody would if you really came to the conclusion that you were not in charge of your mind, this very important, essential feature. I mean, that's a showstopper. That's something that should get you to start thinking, maybe I should do something about that. And here's a very simple way of testing that out. It's kind of, and I do it many times with people, and people are always shocked by this. And that is, it's a simple meditation experiment where you just ask somebody to, I'm not going to go into the details here of it, but to get into a meditative state, to go within, and all we're going to do is concentrate on one thing, of having no thoughts at all, and just focusing on your breath and counting from 1 to 100 for 100 seconds. You know, let's see if you can control your mind, your mind. Remember, it's your mind, the essence of your being, for 100 seconds. Okay? One for exhale, or one for inhale, two for exhale, and carry it to 100. A mere 100 seconds. Most people find they can't do it. As a matter of fact, if you ask them afterwards, well, what was happening during those, we're talking of 100 seconds now, they'll say, well, I was getting angry at myself that I couldn't do it. I was thinking of bills that I had to pay. I had sexual thoughts, you know, and on and on and on. And I thought, and then what I point out, I say, well, wow, if you can control your mind for 100 seconds when you're trying, now here you're trying, you really want to do this, what's happening when you're just being casual? You're walking down the street. You're watching television, you're having a conversation with somebody, and you're not consciously trying to control your mind. What's happening? Well, could this explain why suddenly we have, and you discussed this, Armand, you pointed out about physiological reactions, that suddenly you feel agitated, And then you get angry about being agitated. So that pumps more hormones into you. Then you have another reaction and another reaction. And then you finally say, gee, I don't know what happened to me. Now, isn't that an example of ordinary thinking and an example of how out of control our minds are? And we haven't really paid very much attention to that.
Yeah, I think, Bernie, that's a very good point. And I think, for example, anxiety, people who have panic attacks, you know, it's very hard when you're having a panic attack to believe that you're not going to die. You know, you believe that something is going to hurt you, you're going to hurt yourself, that you're going to die in some way. And yet panic attacks take a certain toll on the human energy system, and they only last 20 minutes. So you've got this thing, which is we kind of know, which is at your greatest amount of anxiety, 20 minutes is all that you could last. So if I'm a doctor, and I know somebody's in a waiting room with a panic attack, you know what I do? I have them wait. Because I know 20 minutes from now they're going to come in and they're going to say, I was feeling panic, but I guess because I felt safe in the hospital, I calmed down. Truth is, you're going to calm down anyway, but we give you a safe environment. Well, meaning that everything that took place in your mind for all that time, for all that 20 minutes, all that panic you were going through, my friends, zero means nothing.
And if the person were able to do what you said before, invoke that stepping back, okay, that would be an even higher
then they step. Wouldn't have been in the hospital. Mm-hmm. You know, the doctor invokes the back, because when you go rushing up to a doctor and you say, panic, panic, doctor, it's an emergency, you got to talk to me. The doctor steps back from himself and his own reaction, which may be, I got to take care of you, and says, well, wait a minute now, what's the best thing for this person? You know, he may have to step back from his own mind as well. We very often have to step out of ourselves to see ourselves, to see what's best, especially with our children, and we're trying to teach them. But most often, most people are on automatic.
Right, because that doesn't happen, so it starts feeding on itself, and you get a reaction to the reaction, and it goes on, and it starts escalating and building.
Now, this is the way we do it here in the West. Let's talk about a different, almost similar, but different perception that comes from the East. And we're going to talk about the Buddhist perception of the mind. Let me introduce that to you. So here we have the Western concept of the mind is everything you think. Let's talk about the Eastern perception of it, and that the mind is something that you could simplify, is again a Western idea. Bernie, let's talk about the Buddhist mind.
Well, where can we begin?
Let's begin with the definition of mind. Mind is a state of clarity. It is a state of light. It is a state of clear being. There's a beginning.
Yes. From the Buddhist perspective, there's two different levels or aspects of mind. Okay. So when the Buddhist talks about Buddha mind, it's really talking about the original mind, original state of higher consciousness, which is pure awareness, or another term that Buddhists use is emptiness, that it has no content. Whereas when we talk about mind here in the West and all the things we've been discussing today, we're talking about thoughts and thinking and the cluttered mind. Okay, and the Buddhists are talking about this original factory-installed equipment called awareness, consciousness, emptiness.
Well, I like the way you say that. You know, imagine the other day I was buying a new computer. The year ago I was buying a new computer. And I said, having had many computers, I always had to take whatever that data was on the previous computer and put it on the new computer. But a lot of it included some junk that was making the computer dysfunctional. So I said, I want a clean install, is what I said. And that has many problems to it, clean installation. It means I don't want anything that from the past. I just want all new programs and all new data. And I realized that I wanted that because I wanted to start off from scratch somewhere. We can't, according to the Buddha mind, the clean install is what you're going to go for. You are looking to get to the original clear mind, free of the thoughts.
And when you're able to do that, then you're living in what's called the now moment, okay, in the present. The problem with the thinking mind or that lower mind that we were talking about, that we live by, and that's very important. We shouldn't really put that down or knock that, because we need that mind, that ego, that me, self, to function in the world. I mean, we shouldn't minimize that, okay? So we need to play that out as well, but at the same time, we need to be lodged in this other place where we could have clarity, where we could have peace of mind, and where we could be living in the now moment. Because most of what we do with thinking is involved. Where do the thoughts come from? Comes from past experience, and then we want to deal with our problems. And where does that take us? To the future, so that we're rarely in that now moment.
But let's stick with the Buddhist mind for a moment. Now you're crossing back and forth. Okay? In the Buddhist mind, the ultimate nature of mind is essentially pure. The pristine nature is technically called clear light. The various afflictive emotions, now get this, afflictive emotions, desire, hatred, and jealousy are products of conditioning, according to the Buddhist mind. They are not intrinsic qualities of the mind because the mind can be cleansed of them. When this clear light nature of mind is veiled or inhibited from expressing its true essence by a conditioning of the afflictive emotions. Now, that's an interesting concept. When your afflictive emotions, which are a desire, hatred, and jealousy, when they take possession of your mind, they block the intrinsic qualities of your being able to be in this clear light. And the person is said to be caught in the cycle of existence. But when, by applying appropriate techniques and practices of meditation, the individual is able to fully experience the clear light nature of mind, free from the influence and conditioning of the afflictive states, he or she is on the way to true liberation and full enlightenment. Hence, from the Buddhist point of view, both bondage and true freedom depends on the varying states of this clear light mind, and requires that you bypass as many things as you can to go to this clear state mind. Now, we on the West, I think we're a little different here in the West. We in the West are saying, let's look at what you're thinking, and let's sort through what you're thinking as to what is real and what is not. And more in the Buddhist mind, I think they are saying nothing is real. That you're in the matrix, and that nothing is real, and that what you want to do is reach towards the matrix. You want to reach towards the clear mind. That's an interesting difference between the two. When we get back from our break, we're going to talk about a third perception that I think is kind of fascinating. This is Armand DeMille with you with Dr. Bernard Starr. Let's get two messages out there. Number one to Skates, who did call, by the way, from those of you who heard yesterday and made an appointment with me. Skates, we didn't get your phone number right. I want to get your phone number because I want to call you back. We have to change that appointment. I want to make it sooner. So would you call us back, please, again, and leave a different phone number for us? And that's to Skates. And to the rest of you who are coming up to a brand new year, I want you to know that tomorrow I've pre-recorded a special show for New Year's Day. I will not be with you live, but a special show with some special music. And let's all hope that in 2009 we don't look at back at 2008 and say those were the good old days. You know, I mean, let's watch the future and watch it unfold in the most positive way possible, because we deserve it. I mean, you see, in many ways, I think this year has been like the Buddha mind. It's been a clarity. It's been saying these illusions have all been taken away. The illusions of where your money is safe and the price of your house and the value of you is your house and your possessions and your 401k. And I think the Buddhist are kind of looking at us and saying, yeah, well, now you're reduced to pure clarity. And that was the idea. Big deal. Hey, I'll be back with you in just a few minutes. Armand DeMille, a little special music for you. I'll be back in just a couple of minutes.
I created a dream.
fly away. Hey, this is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind, WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial. Tune in for more of that music tomorrow at 1 o'clock. We'll be playing music just like that, world music. I'm here with Dr. Bernard Shaw. Star. Kent Robert Shaw, Bernie Star. And we're talking about the positive mind. We're talking about the mind itself. Of course, Bernie is the author of Escape from Your Own Prison, Why We Need Spirituality and Psychology to Be Truly Free. And he writes a column on spiritual psychology, so he kind of knows the difference between the two. So, Bernie, here we have the beautiful Eastern philosophy of Buddhism, which kind of states a number of things that are very, very valuable tenets of the way of seeing yourself. And, you know, it's an amazing thing how many Americans admire and pull into their own lives parts of Buddhism, like, you know, on the West Coast, in Beverly Hills, you'll have a person who lives in a $5 million house, and they have a Zen garden somewhere outside their house. You want to kind of pull in pieces of it. But they don't want to embrace the entire philosophy, which may be one to separate yourself from everything, to do zazen, to do this strenuous kind of meditation and bring yourself to the ultimate mind. People have kind of looked to an amalgam, a melding of different philosophies, because we understand the Western philosophy is not good enough.
Well, that's true. A lot of people do feel uncomfortable with some of the Eastern traditions. It's, alien to them, to their upbringing, to the religions that they grew up in, although they're very much drawn to ideas like mindfulness and the original mind. And, and also this notion that it's part of us, really, that you don't really have to seek something. It's not something you have to struggle to find. It's returning, as the Buddha say, to your original nature. Okay. In fact, in Buddhism, there's this saying, if you see the Buddha on the road, kill him. Now, that doesn't sound very Buddhist. It sounds unfriendly. But what they mean is there is no Buddha on the road. There is nothing out there. It's all within you. Okay. But again, as you point out, people will embrace that notion of mindfulness, of emptiness, of higher consciousness. But they feel that in doing some of these practices, they're uncomfortable with it. So the question arises.
It might be just too big a stretch. You know, if you're born into a Buddhist world or a world that's of that culture, or if you have Buddhist family, you know, you may have seen people who are living without stuff. But if you're a kid growing up in Manhattan or in New York, possessions and comforts are all around you, and the clothing you wear, and the, you know, whether you're going to wear one kind of fabric or another kind of fabric, and what you aspire to, it's really part of your foundation. So it's a huge leap. I have seen Buddhists come here and leap into the American way, but I've seen quite a few Americans who go there to India and meditate, and they completely accept, you know, the Buddhist way, and it's a tremendous thing for them when they do it.
Yes, but the question is that the only way to do it? Is that the only authentic way? I mean, I had the same feeling.
Is it all or nothing, right?
Yeah, when I visited Sai Baba's ashram a number of years ago in India.
Good old Sai.
Good old Sai. And there everybody dresses in these Punjabis, these white outfits, and everybody looks Indian. And at one point I said, gee, to embrace these universal, and remember all of the gurus, even all of the spiritual traditions, say these principles are universal. And when you go down to the core, they are. They have to do with basically the psychology of mind. And I asked myself, well, why do I have to become an Indian or dress like an Indian or take on an Indian name or a Japanese name to embrace these practices, these philosophies of mind? And I concluded that you don't. that the principles are the principles and that they could be practiced in a Western mode as well, and that we don't have to abandon our culture, our traditions. And the fact is, just to reinforce that point, if you go back historically and see how these various traditions developed, you'd be very hard-pressed to find which is the original, the authentic one. In other words, Buddhism itself came out of Hinduism, and the original form was Indian, and then it gravitated into South Asia, Theravada Buddhism, and it took on a certain form. It went to Tibet and became Mahayana Buddhism with their practices and their particular ways of meditating. It went to Japan and became Zen and has very strictly elements of Japanese culture in it. I've been to Zendos, and you start feeling like you're Japanese there. There's nothing wrong with that. But it's clear that all of these traditions, which we now consider the authentic ones...
I can see why. I remember on a long search of my own where I was told to wear orange and to give up all other clothing and just wear orange robes all the time. And that would be my way of embracing the practice. That in order to do that, to wear orange, which I didn't think looked so good on me...
Yeah, that's considered the color of enlightenment.
Sure. But in order to give up everything I believed to wear orange, it meant I had to really give up everything, and it would mean that I wouldn't be trying to get the right orange-fitting clothing that would press just right and had the right amount of orange shine. You know, you would give that up. And you'd give up all attachment to all materialism, and it's a symbolic act by doing it. So by dressing as non-distinct, you, in a way, are taking a step towards that Buddha mind. So I could understand that argument also, but let me ask you about something else you know about that's rarely discussed, and I know it's pretty risky to talk about. Let's talk about child care, according to Eastern philosophy and Western philosophy, and child care according to Buddhism, as you've, from what you've learned about it?
Well, that's a very interesting question. Being a psychologist myself and having taught developmental child psychology for most of my career when I taught at Brooklyn College, one of the things that I noticed when I got initially interested in Eastern traditions was that they had no child psychology. That the psychology is really very crude. It predates our scientific psychology, so most of it is this children and adults. And I believe that some of the issues, which we're not going to get into today, but some of the thorny issues of spirituality can be understood in terms of how we develop from childhood onward, and also some of the things that are rejected by Eastern traditions, that from a developmental psychology point of view, in terms of how what we know about children and their needs and how they develop and how they develop the social and emotional and other skills to function in the world, are very important, and they're totally lacking. And I'll give you a dramatic example of that, of how absent the understanding of children is. If you think about it, here we could talk about some of the great figures of religion and spirituality. Let's say Moses. Let's say Jesus. What do we know about their childhoods? You know, how come we've been told nothing? In the case of Jesus, two of the Gospels have the nativity scene, okay? And then he disappears because of the threat to his life from Herod, so they go to Egypt. The next time you hear about Jesus, he's 12 years old, and he's on the steps of the temple, okay, debating the rabbis. And then he disappears again, and he appears at age 29 when he's being baptized by John the Baptist. You know, similarly with Moses, we have this little vignette. He's put in the basket, floats down the river. The next time we hear about him, he's a prince of Egypt, and then one thing leads to another, and he becomes Moses the prophet. Okay, now that would be that story tells us nothing about their psychological development. That every student or anybody who stopped on the street would say that if you want to know how somebody ticks, you'd have to know all about their childhood and all of the things that we know feed into it. How come these traditions tell us nothing about children? Absolutely nothing. very fascinating thing.
It's really fascinating. They tell us nothing about childhood. They consider it insignificant until the person reaches adulthood.
And by the way, Armand, it's not because
there some kings who became kings when they were children? You know, when they were like the king of Rome or the, you know.
Well, true. That's true.
I mean, those are, but they, I guess they were never children.
Right, but we don't know anything about their development, the things that we consider important. Were they breastfed early? Were they toilet trained? Did they have traumas in their life? Did they have role models? What were the influences? You know, all the things that we consider essential for molding a person into the person who they ultimately become.
How could Jesus have been a crying baby? You know, impossible. You're son of God. How could you cry?
Well, we don't know.
You know, they, sure. Ah, I want milk. You can't. You're the son of God. It's, you know, it's like the Pope riding around in a bulletproof car. What are you afraid of if you can't,
well, that may be the case, but still, you know, why is it that nobody ever considered this important or wrote about it?
There, what do you think?
Oh, I know the answer.
Let me hear the answer.
The answer is that before scientific psychology entered the picture, before Freud came along, okay, the dominant view of how we're talking about the question, what makes us tick? How do we become who we become as an adult? And through much of history, up until fairly recently, the answer was, it was destiny, okay, that you were wired that way. Today we would call it the biological view, that you're wired for it. In other words, if you survive childhood, and throughout much of history that was, you know, very risky, you had a lot of infant mortality, okay, but if you survived, you would become the person that you were destined to become.
Mm.
That if Moses survives childhood, he's destined to be Moses the prophet. Jesus is destined to be the Messiah from the Christian point of view. And it doesn't matter what happens to you in between. Okay? Mm. That was the view of how people developed. Now, that radically changed when scientific psychology came along and all of our theoreticians. And we shifted to the other extreme, at the beginning at least, that it's not nature, it's all nurture, it's what happens to you that shapes you. And once we reached that conclusion, then we wanted to look into every nook and cranny of our personal experiences, and that's what we continue to do. Isn't that what many therapies are about?
But wouldn't, so what do they do? I mean, what do the Buddhists do when it comes to child rearing? How do they bring up their kids? What do they say?
Oh, well, I mean, instinct and mothering and parenting.
All of that is natural.
There's a lot of it.
And you tell the kid you've got to go to school? I mean, if you're a Buddhist,
there's
a
lot of that, which is natural. But in terms of how they explain what you eventually become, their notion was basically one of its inborn, its destiny. So that
it would be tough having a Buddhist family who is teaching you Buddhist philosophy growing up in a public school in New York. You know what I mean? You go to a public school and somebody steals your bag and you come home and your mother said, well, it belongs to everybody. You know what I mean? How do you deal with your how do you deal with this mixture of the culture? How do you deal with it? It's very difficult.
It is. And that's an interesting question. I've heard people talk glibly about educating children with a spiritual orientation, you know, teach them detachment and teach them about higher consciousness. But I would recommend some caution there and add that we don't really know very much about it, I mean, given this whole history that I just very briefly skimmed over, and that it's a subject that we need to look into, of, you know, just how you introduce these ideas. And it's very fascinating. There's one great spiritual teacher called Nisargadatta Maharaj. He wrote a book called I Am That, and he's considered one of the great sages. And there, too, there's nothing about children, but in one of his conversations, and this grabbed my attention in light of what we're talking about here, where the question is said to him, should we teach children detachment, the very thing that we were talking about before, which is essential to this higher consciousness and this mindfulness. And he was the master of emphasizing detachment. And Nisargadatta fired back, no, he said, you shouldn't teach children that because they will have no ambition. And I thought, wow. But because there was no interest in child development, the question wasn't pursued, and I would have been fascinated to hear him elaborate on that more. Okay, but I think that it's true that there are dangers to that, and we don't understand it, and we need. And here's where Western spirituality can make a contribution, where we as psychologists, as social workers, as sociologists can apply our understanding of children to how that relates to the evolution of consciousness and different states of consciousness.
Well, what do you think, Bernie? Do you think that in a higher level of consciousness, a person would not have ambition? What do you think?
No, I don't think that that's true, but the question is if you come to that state later in life or as an adult, that's different than, unless you're some highly evolved, you're born an avatar, a Jesus, a Buddha, a Moses, et cetera, that maybe that wouldn't be true. But I think it's a big question mark if it would destroy ambition early on. I don't think we know very much about it.
You know, it's a funny thing. I think we all have these primitive genes, and I often wonder if everybody reached consciousness at the same time, who would cut the lawn? You know, who would pick the flower? Who would get the food? Everybody would be just sitting staring at the sun. And who would really gather? Who would make things work? And is it that what we have in society is that we have Homo sapiens kind of going into two arms, and one arm is called this kind of competitive, I've got to get what I've got to get, and I've got to grow things, and I've got to get the oil from out of the ground to use for cars so that we could spin things. And there's another group who is a high consciousness group who says, I don't have to do anything, because in effect I'm being fed by the worker ants. You know, the worker ants are the ones who are doing all this competition. And then slowly but surely what I find happening to people is they evolve. And they say, wait a minute. It's that I like having money, but I like having love instead, and I like having peace and quiet instead. And slowly the ones who may have been the movers and the shakers drop out and become more peaceful, not out of default, not because they can't afford to, but because they are moving towards a way of saying, you know, I've done my piece. I've had enough. I think that's the whole idea of what I think, on some level, Medicare works. It's got this thing, you know, it says you're 62, you're 65 years old, you could retire. Retire means we're going to send you some money back out of the money you paid all your life to the government. We're going to send you some money so that you could take it a little easier. Which it works, believe it or not, you do get some money. And then they say, and if you're too tired by the time you're 62, we're going to start sending you the money now. We're going to start sending it to you at 62 so that you could start taking it easy now. You're not going to get as much as you would get if you waited to 65, but it's kind of a funny thing that we built into this Western society, this concept of some kind of money for retirement that you could get, that you could actually begin to kind of, and it's based on your earnings, too. It's based on how much effort you've put in throughout your life. If you've worked hard and earned a lot of money, that's how much you kind of start getting back. It's not like we give the same free amount to everybody. So we have this funny Western approach to helping people step up or take the opportunity to bring themselves to some kind of more peaceful, beautiful life. And I think we have images. We have images that we're in agreement with both in Buddhism and in the Western world, that a world of peace, a life of peace, a life of beauty, a life of just kind of taking it easy and being kind and being positive. I think that's what kind of counts the most to almost everybody. Hopefully, at least to all the people who are listening to us on WBAI. Hey, this is Armand DeMille. It has been an absolute pleasure being with you during this time here on WBAI. And Bernie, thanks so much for joining us again.
Well, thank you. It was terrific being here again.
Yeah, remember, tune in tomorrow for a special program during this time. And I will be back with you on Tuesday as well, at 1 p.m., my friends, with some special guests. Look forward to seeing you then. If you want to send me an email or you want to reach Bernie, you can do it at thepositivemind.com, Armand at thepositivemind.com. Bye-bye for now.